operates on the assumption, she read, that no boy should be deterred from applying for admission because his family is unable to pay the full cost of a Whitehill education. With this in mind, the admissions committee selects each year from approximately 3,000 candidates the 150 most promising and deserving boys, regardless of their parents' ability to pay the full $2,200 tuition. And those in need of financial aid are given it to the full extent of their need. In certain instances, the school will even pay for the clothing and transportation of a boy. Sylvia shook her head. I think that's perfectly amazing. It's something most people don't realize at all. A truck driver's son can come to Whitehill.
If he's smart enough, he said.
Thanks to the Remenzels, said Sylvia with pride.
And a lot of other people, too, said the doctor.
Sylvia read out loud again. In 1799, Eli Remenzel laid the foundation for the present scholarship fund by donating to the school 40 acres in Boston. The school still owns 12 of those acres, their current evaluation being $3 million.
Eli, said the doctor, sit up. What's the matter with you?
Eli sat up again, but began to slump almost immediately, like a snowman in hell. Eli had good reason for slumping, for actually hoping to die or disappear. He could not bring himself to say what the reason was. He slumped because he knew he had been denied admission to Whitehill. He had failed the entrance examinations. Eli's parents did not know this, because Eli had found the awful notice in the mail and had torn it up. Dr. Remenzel and his wife had no doubts whatsoever about their son's getting into Whitehill. It was inconceivable to them that Eli could not go there, so they had no curiosity as to how Eli had done on the examinations, were not puzzled when no report ever came. "What all will Eli have to do to enroll?" said Sylvia, as the black Rolls-Royce crossed the Rhode Island border.
"I don't know," said the doctor. "I suppose they've got it all complicated now, with forms to be filled out in quadruplicate and punch-card machines and bureaucrats. This business of entrance examinations is all new, too. In my day, a boy simply had an interview with the headmaster. The headmaster would look him over, ask him a few questions, and then say, 'There's a Whitehill boy.'"
"Did he ever say, 'There isn't a Whitehill boy?'" said Sylvia.
"Oh, sure," said Dr. Remenzel, "if a boy was impossibly stupid or something. There have to be standards. There have always been standards. The African boys have to meet the standards just like anybody else. They aren't getting in just because the State Department wants to make friends. We made that clear. Those boys had to meet the standards."
"And they did?" said Sylvia.
"I suppose," said Dr. Remenzel. "I heard they're all in, and they all took the same examination Eli did."
"Was it a hard examination, dear?" Sylvia asked Eli. It was the first time she'd thought to ask.
Said Eli.
"What?"
she said.
"Yes," said Eli. "I'm glad they've got high standards," she said.
And then she realized that this was a fairly silly statement.
"Well, of course they've got high standards," she said. "That's why it's such a famous school. That's why people who go there do so well in later life."
Sylvia resumed her reading of the catalog again, opened out a folding map of the Sward, as the campus of Whitehill was traditionally called. She read off the names of features that memorialized Remenzels: the Sanford Remenzel Bird Sanctuary, the George McClellan Remenzel Skating Rink, the Eli Remenzel Memorial Dormitory. And then she read out loud a quatrain printed on one corner of the map.
"When night falleth gently upon the green sward, it's Whitehill, dear Whitehill, our thoughts all turn toward." "You know," said Sylvia, "school songs are so corny when you just read them. But when I hear the glee club sing those words, they sound like the most beautiful words ever written, and I want to cry."
Said Dr. Remenzel.
"Did a Remenzel write them?"
"I don't think so," said Dr. Remenzel. And then he said, "No, wait. That's the new song. Remenzel didn't write it. Tom Kyler wrote it.
The man in that old car we passed?
Sure, said Dr. Remenzel. Tom wrote it. I remember when he wrote it.
A scholarship boy wrote it? Said Sylvia. I think that's awfully nice. He was a scholarship boy, wasn't he?
His father was an ordinary automobile mechanic in North Marston.
You hear what a democratic school you're going to, Eli? Said Sylvia.
Half an hour later, Ben Barkley brought the limousine to a stop before the Holly House, a rambling country inn 20 years older than the Republic. The inn was on the edge of the White Hill Sward, glimpsing the school's rooftops and spires over the innocent wilderness of the Sanford Remenzel Bird Sanctuary. Ben Barkley was sent away with the car for an hour and a half. Dr. Remenzel shepherded Sylvia and Eli into a familiar low-ceiling world of pewter, clocks, lovely old woods, agreeable servants, elegant food and drink. Eli, clumsy with horror of what was surely to come, banged a grandmother clock with his elbow as he passed, made the clock cry. Sylvia excused herself. Dr. Remenzel and Eli went to the threshold of the dining room, where a hostess welcomed them both by name. They were given a table beneath an oil portrait of one of the three White Hill boys who had gone on to become President of the United States. The dining room was filling quickly with families. What every family had was at least one boy about Eli's age. Most of the boys wore White Hill blazers, black with pale blue piping, with White Hill seals on their breast pockets. A few, like Eli, were not yet entitled to wear blazers, were simply hoping to get in. The doctor ordered a martini, then turned to his son and said, "Your mother has the idea that you're entitled to special privileges around here. I hope you don't have that idea, too."
"No, sir," said Eli.
"It would be a source of the greatest embarrassment to me," said Dr. Remenzel with considerable grandeur, "if I were ever to hear that you had used the name Remenzel as though you thought Remenzels were something special."
"I know," said Eli wretchedly.
"That settles it," said the doctor. He had nothing more to say about it. He gave abbreviated salutes to several people he knew in the room, speculated as to what sort of party had reserved a long banquet table that was set up along one wall. He decided that it was for a visiting athletic team. Sylvia arrived, and Eli had to be told in a sharp whisper to stand when a woman came to a table. Sylvia was full of news. The long table, she related, was for the 30 boys from Africa.
"I'll bet that's more colored people than have eaten here since this place was founded," she said softly. "How fast things change these days."
"You're right about how fast things change," said Dr. Remenzel. "You're wrong about the colored people who've eaten here. This used to be a busy part of the Underground Railroad."
"Really?" said Sylvia. "How exciting."
She looked all about herself in a bird-like way.
"I think everything's exciting here. I only wish Eli had a blazer on."
Dr. Remenzel reddened.
"He isn't entitled to one," he said. "I know that," said Sylvia.
"I thought you were going to ask somebody for permission to put a blazer on Eli right away," said the doctor.
"I wouldn't do that," said Sylvia, a little offended now. "Why are you always afraid I'll embarrass you?"
"Never mind. Excuse me. Forget it," said Dr. Remenzel. Sylvia brightened again, put her hand on Eli's arm, and looked radiantly at a man in the dining room doorway.
"There's my favorite person in all the world, next to my son and husband," she said.
She meant Dr. Donald Warren, headmaster of the White Hill School. A thin gentleman in his early 60s, Dr. Warren was in the doorway with the manager of the inn, looking over the arrangements for the Africans. It was then that Eli got up abruptly, fled the dining room, fled as much of the nightmare as he could possibly leave behind. He brushed past Dr. Warren rudely, though he knew him well, though Dr. Warren spoke his name. Dr. Warren looked after him sadly.
"I'll be damned," said Dr. Remenzel. "What brought that on?"
Maybe he really is sick, said Sylvia.
The Remenzels had no time to react more elaborately, because Dr. Warren spotted them and crossed quickly to their table. He greeted them, some of his perplexity about Eli showing in his greeting. He asked if he might sit down.
Certainly, of course, said Dr. Remenzel expansively. We'd be honored if you did.
Heavens!
Not to eat, said Dr. Warren. I'll be eating at the long table with the new boys. I would like to talk, though.
He saw that there were five places set at the table.
You're expecting someone?
We passed Tom Hillier and his boy on the way, said Dr. Remenzel. They'll be along in a minute.
Good, good, said Dr. Warren absently.
He fidgeted, looked again in the direction in which Eli had disappeared.
Tom's boy will be going to White Hill in the fall? Said Dr. Remenzel.
Hmm?
Said Dr. Warren.
Oh, yes, 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 he will. Is he a scholarship boy like his father? Said Sylvia.
That's not a polite question, said Dr. Remenzel severely.
I beg your pardon, said Sylvia.
No, no, that's a perfectly proper question these days, said Dr. Warren. We don't keep that sort of information very secret anymore. We're proud of our scholarship boys, and they have every reason to be proud of themselves. Tom's boy got the highest score anyone's ever got on the entrance examinations. We feel privileged to have him.
We never did find out Eli's score, said Dr. Remenzel.
He said it with good-humored resignation, without expectation that Eli had done especially well.
A good strong medium, I imagine, said Sylvia.
She said this on the basis of Eli's grades in primary school, which had ranged from medium to terrible. The headmaster looked surprised.
I didn't tell you his scores, he said.
We haven't seen you since he took the examinations, said Dr. Remenzel.
The letter I wrote you, said Dr. Warren.
What letter? Said Dr. Remenzel. Did we get a letter?
A letter from me, said Dr. Warren, with growing incredulity. The hardest letter I ever had to write.
Sylvia shook her head. We never got any letter from you. Dr. Warren sat back, looking very ill.
I mailed it myself, he said. It was definitely mailed. 2 weeks ago.
Dr. Remenzel shrugged.
The U.S. mails don't lose much, he said. But I guess that now and then something gets misplaced.
Dr. Warren cradled his head in his hands.
Oh, dear. Oh, my. Oh, Lord. He said. I was surprised to see Eli here. I wondered that he would want to come along with you.
He didn't come along just to see the scenery, said Dr. Remenzel. He came to enroll.
I want to know what was in the letter, said Sylvia.
Dr. Warren raised his head, folded his hands.
What the letter said was this, and no other words could be more difficult for me to say. On the basis of his work in primary school and his scores on the entrance examinations, I must tell you that your son and my good friend Eli cannot possibly do the work required of boys at White Hill.
Dr. Warren's voice steadied, and so did his gaze.
To admit Eli to White Hill, to expect him to do White Hill work, he said, would be both unrealistic and cruel.
30 African boys, escorted by several faculty members, State Department men, and diplomats from their own countries, filed into the dining room. And Tom Hillier and his boy, having no idea that something had just gone awfully wrong for the Remenzels, came in too, and said hello to the Remenzels and Dr. Warren gaily, as though life couldn't possibly be better.
"I'll talk to you more about this later, if you like," Dr. Warren said to the Remenzels, rising. "I have to go now, but later on..."
He left quickly.
"My mind's a blank," said Sylvia. "My mind's a perfect blank."
Tom Hillier and his boy sat down. Hillier looked at the menu before him, clapped his hands, and said,
"What's good? I'm hungry."
and then he said, "Say, where's your boy?"
"He stepped out for a moment," said Dr. Remenzel evenly.
"We've got to find him," said Sylvia to her husband.
"In time, in due time," said Dr. Remenzel.
"That letter," said Sylvia. "Eli knew about it. He found it and tore it up. Of course he did."
She started to cry, thinking of the hideous trap that Eli had caught himself in.
"I'm not interested right now in what Eli's done," said Dr. Remenzel. "Right now, I'm a lot more interested in what some other people are going to do."
"What do you mean?" said Sylvia.
Dr. Remenzel stood impressively, angry and determined. "I mean," he said, "I'm going to see how quickly people can change their minds around here."
"Please," said Sylvia, trying to hold him, trying to calm him. "We've got to find Eli. That's the first thing."
"The first thing," said Dr. Remenzel quite loudly, "is to get Eli admitted to Whitehill. After that, we'll find him, and we'll bring him back."
"But, darling," said Sylvia.
"No but about it," said Dr. Remenzel. "There's a majority of the Board of Overseers in this room at this very moment. Every one of them is a close friend of mine, or a close friend of my father. If they tell Dr. Warren Eli's in, that's it. Eli's in. If there's room for all these other people," he said, "there's damn well room for Eli, too."
He strode quickly to a table nearby, sat down heavily, and began to talk to a fierce-looking and splendid old gentleman who was eating there. The old gentleman was chairman of the board. Sylvia apologized to the baffled Hilliers, and then went in search of Eli. Asking this person and that person, Sylvia found him. He was outside, all alone on a bench in a bower of lilacs that had just begun to bud. Eli heard his mother's coming on the gravel path, stayed where he was, resigned.
"Did you find out?" he said. "Or do I still have to tell you?"
"About you?" she said gently. "About not getting in? Dr. Warren told us."
"I tore his letter up," said Eli.
"I can understand that," she said. "Your father and I have always made you feel that you had to go to Whitehill, that nothing else would do."
"I feel better," said Eli.
He tried to smile, found he could do it easily.
"I feel so much better now that it's over. I tried to tell you a couple of times, but I just couldn't. I didn't know how."
"That's my fault, not yours," she said.
"What's father doing?" said Eli.
Sylvia was so intent on comforting Eli that she'd put out of her mind what her husband was up to. Now she realized that Dr. Remenzel was making a ghastly mistake. She didn't want Eli admitted to Whitehill. Could see what a cruel thing that would be. She couldn't bring herself to tell the boy what his father was doing, so she said,
"He'll be along in a minute, dear. He understands."
And then she said, "You wait here, and I'll go get him and come right back." But she didn't have to go to Dr. Remenzel. At that moment, the big man came out of the inn and caught sight of his wife and son. He came to her and Eli. He looked dazed.
"Well," she said. They all said no," said Dr. Remenzel, very subdued. "That's for the best," said Sylvia. "I'm relieved. I really am."
"Who said no?" said Eli.
"Who said no to what?"
"The members of the board," said Dr. Remenzel, not looking anyone in the eye. "I asked them to make an exception in your case, to reverse their decision and let you in."
Eli stood, his face filled with incredulity and shame that were instant.
"You what?" he said.
And there was no childishness in the way he said it. Next came anger. "You shouldn't have done that," he said to his father. Dr. Remenzel nodded.
"So I've already been told."
"That isn't done," said Eli.
"How awful! You shouldn't have."
"You're right," said Dr. Remenzel, accepting the scolding lamely.
"Now I am ashamed," said Eli, and he showed that he was.
Dr. Remenzel, in his wretchedness, could find no strong words to say. "I apologize to you both," he said at last. "It was a very bad thing to try." "Now Aramenzel has asked for something," said Eli.
"I don't suppose Ben's back yet with the car," said Dr. Aramenzel.
It was obvious that Ben wasn't.
"We'll wait out here for him," he said. "I don't want to go back in there now."
Aramenzel asked for something. As though Aramenzel were something special, said Eli.
"I don't suppose," said Dr. Aramenzel, and he left the sentence unfinished, dangling in the air.
"You don't suppose what?" said his wife, her face puzzled.
"I don't suppose," said Dr. Aramenzel, "that we'll ever be coming here anymore."
Unready to Wear, read by Tony Roberts.
I don't suppose the oldsters, those of us who weren't born into it, will ever feel quite at home being amphibious. Amphibious in the new sense of the word. I still catch myself feeling blue about things that don't matter anymore. I can't help worrying about my business, for instance, or what used to be my business. After all, I spent 30 years building the thing up from scratch, and now the equipment is rusting and getting clogged with dirt. But even though I know it's silly of me to care what happens to the business, I borrow a body from a storage center every so often and go around the old hometown and clean and oil as much of the equipment as I can. Of course, all in the world the equipment was good for was making money, and Lord knows there's plenty of that lying around. Not as much as there used to be, because there at first some people got frisky and threw it all around, and the wind blew it every which way. And a lot of go-getters gathered up piles of the stuff and hid it somewhere. I hate to admit it, but I gathered up close to 500,000 myself and stuck it away. I used to get it out and count it sometimes, but that was years ago. Right now, I'd be hard put to say where it is. But the worrying I do about my old business is Bush League stuff compared to the worrying my wife Madge does about our old house. That thing is what she herself put in 30 years on while I was building the business. Then, no sooner had we gotten nerve enough to build and decorate the place, than everybody we cared anything about got amphibious. Madge borrows a body once a month and dusts the place, though the only thing a house is good for now is keeping termites and mice from getting pneumonia. Whenever it's my turn to get into a body and work as an attendant at the local storage center, I realize all over again how much tougher it is for women to get used to being amphibious. Madge borrows bodies a lot oftener than I do, and that's true of women in general. We have to keep 3 times as many women's bodies in stock as men's bodies in order to meet the demand. Every so often, it seems as though a woman just has to have a body and doll it up in clothes and look at herself in a mirror. And Madge, God bless her, I don't think she'll be satisfied until she's tried on every body in every storage center on Earth. It's been a fine thing for Madge, though. I never kid her about it because it's done so much for her personality. Her old body, to tell you the plain, blunt truth, wasn't anything to get excited about. And having to haul the thing around made her gloomy a lot of the time in the old days. She couldn't help it, poor soul, any more than anybody else could help what sort of body they'd been born with. And I loved her in spite of it. Well, after we'd learned to be amphibious, and after we'd built the storage centers and laid in body supplies and opened them to the public, Madge went hog wild. She borrowed a platinum blonde body that had been donated by a burlesque queen, and I didn't think we'd ever get her out of it. As I say, it did wonders for her self-confidence. I'm like most men and don't care particularly what body I get. Just the strong, good-looking, healthy bodies were put in storage, so one is as good as the next one. Sometimes, when Madge and I take bodies out together for old time's sake, I let her pick out one for me to match whatever she's got on. It's a funny thing how she always picks a blonde, tall one for me. My old body, which she claims she loved for a third of a century, had black hair and was short and paunchy, too, there toward the last. I'm human, and I couldn't help being hurt when they scrapped it after I'd left it, instead of putting it in storage. It was a good, homey, comfortable body. Nothing fast and flashy, but reliable. But there isn't much call for that kind of body at the centers, I guess. I never ask for one, at any rate. The worst experience I ever had with a body was when I was flimflammed into taking out the one that had belonged to Dr. Ellis Koenigswasser. It belongs to the Amphibious Pioneers Society and only gets taken out once a year for the big Pioneers' Day parade on the anniversary of Koenigswasser's discovery. Everybody said it was a great honor for me to be picked to get into Koenigswasser's body and lead the parade. Like a plain damn fool, I believed them. They'll have a tough time getting me into that thing again, ever. Taking that wreck out certainly made it plain why Koenigswasser discovered how people could do without their bodies. That old one of his practically drives you out. Ulcers, headaches, arthritis, fallen arches, a nose like a pruning hook, piggy little eyes, and a complexion like a used steamer trunk. He was, and still is, the sweetest person you'd ever want to know. But back when he was stuck with that body, nobody got close enough to find out. We tried to get Koenigswasser back into his old body to lead us when we first started having the Pioneers' Day parades, but he wouldn't have anything to do with it. So we always have to flatter some poor boob into taking on the job. Koenigswasser marches all right, but as a 6-foot cowboy who can bend beer cans double between his thumb and middle finger. Koenigswasser is just like a kid with that body. He never gets tired of bending beer cans with it, and we all have to stand around in our bodies after the parade and watch as though we were very impressed. I don't suppose he could bend very much of anything back in the old days. Nobody mentions it to him, since he's the grand old man of the amphibious age, but he plays hell with bodies. Almost every time he takes one out, he busts it, showing off. Then somebody has to get into a surgeon's body and sew it up again. I don't mean to be disrespectful of Koenigswasser. As a matter of fact, it's a respectful thing to say that somebody is childish in certain ways, because it's people like that who seem to get all the big ideas. There is a picture of him in the old days down at the Historical Society, and you can see from that that he never did grow up as far as keeping up his appearance went, doing what little he could with the rattletrap body nature had issued him. His hair was down below his collar. He wore his pants so low that his heels wore through the legs above the cuffs, and the lining of his coat hung down in festoons all around the bottom, and he'd forget meals and go out into the cold or wet without enough clothes on, and he would never notice sickness until it almost killed him. He was what we used to call absent-minded. Looking back now, of course, we say he was starting to be amphibious. Koenigswasser was a mathematician, and he did all his living with his mind. The body he had to haul around with that wonderful mind was about as much use to him as a flat car of scrap iron. Whenever he got sick and had to pay some attention to his body, he'd rant somewhat like this. "The mind is the only thing about human beings that's worth anything. Why does it have to be tied to a bag of skin, blood, hair, meat, bones, and tubes? No wonder people can't get anything done. Stuck for life with a parasite that has to be stuffed with food and protected from weather and germs all the time. And the fool thing wears out anyway, no matter how much you stuff and protect it." Who, he wanted to know, really wants one of the things? What's so wonderful about protoplasm that we've got to carry so damned many pounds of it with us wherever we go? "Trouble with the world," said Koenigswasser, "isn't too many people, it's too many bodies." When his teeth went bad on him, and he had to have them all out, and he couldn't get a set of dentures that were at all comfortable, he wrote in his diary, "If living matter was able to evolve enough to get out of the ocean, which was really quite a pleasant place to live, it certainly ought to be able to take another step and get out of bodies, which are pure nuisances when you stop to think about them." He wasn't a prude about bodies, understand, and he wasn't jealous of people who had better ones than he did. He just thought bodies were a lot more trouble than they were worth. He didn't have great hopes that people would really evolve out of their bodies in his time. He just wished they would. Thinking hard about it, he walked through a park in his shirt sleeves and stopped off at the zoo to watch the lions being fed. Then, when the rainstorm turned to sleet, he headed back home and was interested to see firemen on the edge of a lagoon where they were using a pull motor on a drowned man. Witnesses said the old man had walked right into the water and had kept going without changing his expression until he'd disappeared. Koenigswasser got a look at the victim's face and said he'd never seen a better reason for suicide. He started for home again and was almost there before he realized that that was his own body lying back there. He went back to reoccupy the body just as the fireman got it breathing again, and he walked it home more as a favor to the city than anything else. He walked it into his front closet, got out of it again, and left it there. He took it out only when he wanted to do some writing or turn the pages of a book, or when he had to feed it so it would have enough energy to do the few odd jobs he gave it. The rest of the time, it sat motionless in the closet, looking dazed and using almost no energy. Koenigswasser told me the other day that he used to run the thing for about $1 a week, just taking it out when he really needed it. But the best part was that Koenigswasser didn't have to sleep anymore, just because it had to sleep, or be afraid anymore, just because it thought it might get hurt, or go looking for things it seemed to think it had to have. And when it didn't feel well, Koenigswasser kept out of it until it felt better, and he didn't have to spend a fortune keeping the thing comfortable. When he got his body out of the closet to write, he did a book on how to get out of one's own body, which was rejected without comment by 23 publishers. The 24th sold 2 million copies, and the book changed human life more than the invention of fire, numbers, the alphabet, agriculture, or the wheel. When somebody told Koenigswasser that, he snorted that they were damning his book with faint praise. I'd say he had a point there. By following the instructions in Koenigswasser's book for about 2 years, almost anybody could get out of his body whenever he wanted to. The first step was to understand what a parasite and dictator the body was most of the time. Then to separate what the body wanted or didn't want from what you, yourself, your psyche, wanted or didn't want. Then, by concentrating on what you wanted and ignoring as much as possible what the body wanted beyond plain maintenance, you made your psyche demand its rights and become self-sufficient. That's what Koenigswasser had done without realizing it until he and his body had parted company in the park, with his psyche going to watch the lions eat, and with his body wandering out of control into the lagoon. The final trick of separation, once your psyche grew independent enough, was to start your body walking in some direction and suddenly take your psyche off in another direction. You couldn't do it standing still for some reason. You had to walk. At first, Madge and my psyches were clumsy at getting along outside our bodies, like the first sea animals that got stranded on land millions of years ago, and who could just waddle and squirm and gasp in the mud. But we became better at it with time, because the psyche can naturally adapt so much faster than the body. Madge and I had good reason for wanting to get out. Everybody who was crazy enough to try to get out at the first had good reasons. Madge's body was sick and wasn't going to last a lot longer. With her going in a little while, I couldn't work up enthusiasm for sticking around much longer myself. So we studied Koenigswasser's book and tried to get Madge out of her body before it died. I went along with her to keep either one of us from getting lonely. And we just barely made it, 6 weeks before her body went all to pieces. That's why we get to march every year in the Pioneer's Day parade. Not everybody does. Only the first 5,000 of us who turned amphibious. We were guinea pigs, without much to lose one way or another, and we were the ones who proved to the rest how pleasant and safe it was, a heck of a lot safer than taking chances in a body year in and year out. Sooner or later, almost everybody had a good reason for giving it a try. There got to be millions and finally more than 1 billion of us, invisible, insubstantial, indestructible, and by golly, true to ourselves. No trouble to anybody, and not afraid of anything. When we're not in bodies, the amphibious pioneers could meet on the head of a pin. When we get into bodies for the Pioneer's Day parade, we take up over 50,000 square feet, have to gobble more than 3 tons of food to get enough energy to march, and lots of us catch colds, or worse, and get sore because somebody's body accidentally steps on the heel of somebody else's body, and get jealous because some bodies get to lead and others have to stay in ranks, and, oh hell, I don't know what all. I'm not crazy about the parade. With all of us there, close together in bodies, well, it brings out the worst in us, no matter how good our psyches are. Last year, for instance, Pioneer's Day was a scorcher. People couldn't help being out of sorts, stuck in sweltering, thirsty bodies for hours. Well, one thing led to another, and the parade marshal offered to beat the daylights out of my body with his body if my body got out of step again. Naturally, being parade marshal, he had the best body that year, except for Königswasser's cowboy, but I told him to soak his fat head anyway. He swung, and I ditched my body right there and didn't even stick around long enough to find out if he connected. He had to haul my body back to the storage center himself. I stopped being mad at him the minute I got out of the body. I understood, you see. Nobody but a saint could be really sympathetic or intelligent for more than a few minutes at a time in a body, or happy either, except in short spurts. I haven't met an amphibian yet who wasn't easy to get along with and cheerful and interesting as long as he was outside a body. And I haven't met one yet who didn't turn a little sour when he got into one. The minute you get in, chemistry takes over, glands making you excitable or ready to fight or hungry or mad or affectionate or, well, you never know what's going to happen next. That's why I can't get sore at the enemy, the people who are against the amphibians. They never get out of their bodies and won't try to learn. They don't want anybody else to do it either, and they'd like to make the amphibians get back into bodies and stay in them. After the tussle I had with the parade marshal, Madge got wind of it and left her body right in the middle of the ladies' auxiliary, and the two of us, feeling full of devilment after getting shed of the bodies in the parade, went over to have a look at the enemy. I'm never keen on going over to look at them. Madge likes to see what the women are wearing. Stuck with their bodies all the time, the enemy women change their clothes and hair and cosmetic styles a lot oftener than we do on the women's bodies in the storage centers. I don't get much of a kick out of the fashions, and almost everything else you see and hear in enemy territory would bore a plaster statue into moving away. Usually the enemy is talking about old-style reproduction, which is the clumsiest, most comical, most inconvenient thing anyone could imagine, compared with what the amphibians have in that line. If they aren't talking about that, then they're talking about food, the gobs of chemicals they have to stuff into their bodies. Or they'll talk about fear, which we used to call politics. Job politics, social politics, government politics. The enemy hates that, having us able to peek in on them any time we want to. Well, they can't ever see us unless we get into bodies. They seem to be scared to death of us, though being scared of amphibians makes as much sense as being scared of the sunrise. They could have the whole world, except the storage centers, for all the amphibians care. But they bunch together as though we were going to come whooping out of the sky and do something terrible to them at any moment. They've got contraptions all over the place that are supposed to detect amphibians. The gadgets aren't worth a nickel, but they seem to make the enemy feel good, like they were lined up against great forces, but keeping their nerve and doing important, clever things about it. Know-how. All the time they're patting each other about how much know-how they've got, and about how we haven't got anything by comparison. If know-how means weapons, they're dead right. I guess there is a war on between them and us, but we never do anything about holding up our side of the war, except to keep our parade sites and our storage centers secret, and to get out of bodies every time there's an air raid or the enemy fires a rocket or something. That just makes the enemy madder, because the raids and rockets and all cost plenty. And blowing up things nobody needs anyway is a poor return on the taxpayers' money. We always know what they're going to do next, and when and where, so there isn't any trick to keeping out of their way. But they are pretty smart, considering they've got bodies to look after besides doing their thinking, so I always try to be cautious when I go over to watch them. That's why I wanted to clear out when Madge and I saw a storage center in the middle of one of their fields. We hadn't talked to anybody lately about what the enemy was up to, and the center looked awfully suspicious. Madge was optimistic, the way she's been ever since she borrowed that burlesque queen's body, and she said the storage center was a sure sign that the enemy had seen the light, that they were getting ready to become amphibious themselves. Well, it looked like it. There was a brand new center, stocked with bodies and open for business, as innocent as you please. We circled it several times, and Madge's circles got smaller and smaller as she tried to get a close look at what they had in the way of ladies ready to wear. "Let's beat it," I said. "I'm just looking," said Madge. "No harm in looking." Then she saw what was in the main display case, and she forgot where she was or where she'd come from. The most striking woman's body I'd ever seen was in the case. 6 feet tall and built like a goddess. But that wasn't the payoff. The body had copper-colored skin, chartreuse hair and fingernails, and a gold lamé evening gown. Beside that body was the body of a blonde male giant in a pale blue field marshal's uniform, piped in scarlet and spangled with medals. I think the enemy must have swiped the bodies in a raid on one of our outlying storage centers and padded and dyed them and dressed them up. "Madge, come back," I said. The copper-colored woman with the chartreuse hair moved. A siren screamed and soldiers rushed from hiding places to grab the body Madge was in. The center was a trap for amphibians. The body Madge hadn't been able to resist had its ankles tied together, so Madge couldn't take the few steps she had to take if she was going to get out of it again. The soldiers carted her off triumphantly as a prisoner of war. I got into the only body available, the fancy field marshal, to try to help her. It was a hopeless situation, because the field marshal was bait too, with its ankles tied. The soldiers dragged me after Madge. The cocky young major in charge of the soldiers did a jig along the shoulder of the road. He was so proud. He was the first man ever to capture an amphibian, which was really something from the enemy's point of view. They'd been at war with us for years and spent God knows how many billions of dollars, but catching us was the first thing that made any amphibians pay much attention to them. When we got to the town, people were leaning out of windows and waving their flags and cheering the soldiers and hissing Madge and me. Here were all the people who didn't want to be amphibious, who thought it was terrible for anybody to be amphibious. People of all colors, shapes, sizes, and nationalities joined together to fight the amphibians. It turned out that Madge and I were going to have a big trial. After being tied up every which way in jail all night, we were taken to a courtroom where television cameras stared at us. Madge and I were worn to frazzles because neither one of us had been cooped up in a body that long since I don't know when. Just when we needed to think more than we ever had, in jail before the trial, the bodies developed hunger pains, and we couldn't get them comfortable on the cots, no matter how we tried. And, of course, the bodies just had to have their 8 hours sleep. The charge against us was a capital offense on the books of the enemy, desertion. As far as the enemy was concerned, the amphibians had all turned yellow and run out on their bodies just when their bodies were needed to do brave and important things for humanity. We didn't have a hope of being acquitted. The only reason there was a trial at all was that it gave them an opportunity to sound off about why they were so right and we were so wrong. The courtroom was jammed with their big brass, all looking angry and brave and noble. "Mr. Amphibian," said the prosecutor, You are old enough, aren't you, to remember when all men had to face up to life in their bodies and work and fight for what they believed in? I remember when the bodies were always getting into fights, and nobody seemed to know why or how to stop it, I said politely. The only thing everybody seemed to believe in was that they didn't like to fight. What would you say of a soldier who ran away in the face of fire? He wanted to know. I'd say he was scared silly. He was helping to lose the battle, wasn't he? Oh, sure. There wasn't any argument on that one. Isn't that what the amphibians have done? Run out on the human race in the face of the battle of life? Most of us are still alive, if that's what you mean, I said. It was true. We hadn't licked death, and weren't sure we wanted to, but we'd certainly lengthened life something amazing compared to the span you could expect in a body. You ran out on your responsibilities, he said. Like you'd run out of a burning building, sir, I said, leaving everyone else to struggle on alone. They can all get out the same door that we got out of. You can all get out any time you want to. All you do is figure out what you want and what your body wants, and concentrate on... The judge banged his gavel until I thought he'd split it. Here they'd burned every copy of Koenigswasser's book they could find, and there I was giving a course in how to get out of a body over a whole television network. If you amphibians had your way, said the prosecutor, everybody would run out on his responsibilities and let life and progress as we know them disappear completely. Why, sure, I agreed. That's the point. Men would no longer work for what they believe in, he challenged. I had a friend back in the old days who drilled holes in little square thingamajigs for 17 years in a factory, and he never did get a very clear idea of what they were for. Another one I knew grew raisins for a glass-blowing company, and the raisins weren't for anybody to eat, and he never did find out why the company bought them. Things like that make me sick, now that I'm in a body, of course, and what I used to do for a living makes me even sicker. Then you despise human beings and everything they do, he said. I like them fine, better than I ever did before. I just think it's a dirty shame what they have to do to take care of their bodies. You ought to get amphibious and see how happy people can be when they don't have to worry about where their body's next meal is coming from, or how to keep it from freezing in the wintertime, or what's going to happen to them when their body wears out. And that, sir, means the end of ambition, the end of greatness. Oh, I don't know about that, I said. We've got some pretty great people on our side. They'd be great in or out of bodies. It's the end of fear is what it is. I looked right into the lens of the nearest television camera. And that's the most wonderful thing that ever happened to people. Down came the judge's gavel again, and the brass started to shout me down. The television men turned off their cameras, and all the spectators, except for the biggest brass, were cleared out. I knew I'd really said something. All anybody would be getting on his television set now was organ music. When the confusion died down, the judge said the trial was over, and that Madge and I were guilty of desertion. Nothing I could do could get us in any worse, so I talked back. Now I understand, you poor fish, I said. You couldn't get along without fear. That's the only skill you've got, how to scare yourselves and other people into doing things. That's the only fun you've got, watching people jump for fear of what you'll do to their bodies or take away from their bodies. Madge got in her 2 cents worth. The only way you can get any response from anybody is to scare them. Contempt of court, said the judge. The only way you can scare people is if you can keep them in their bodies, I told him. The soldiers grabbed Madge and me and started to drag us out of the courtroom. This means war, I yelled. Everything stopped right there and the place got very quiet. We're already at war, said a general uneasily. Well, we're not, I answered. But we will be if you don't untie Madge and me this instant. I was fierce and impressive in that field marshal's body. You haven't any weapons, said the judge. No know-how. outside of bodies, amphibians, and nothing. If you don't cut us loose by the time I count 10, I told him, the amphibians will occupy the bodies of the whole kit and caboodle of you and march you right off the nearest cliff. The place is surrounded. That was hogwash, of course. Only one person can occupy a body at a time, but the enemy couldn't be sure of that. 1, 2, 3. The general swallowed, turned white, and waved his hand vaguely. Cut them loose, he said weakly. The soldiers, terrified too, were glad to do it. Madge and I were freed. I took a couple of steps, headed my spirit in another direction, and that beautiful field marshal, medals and all, went crashing down the staircase like a grandfather clock. I realized that Madge wasn't with me. She was still in that copper-colored body with the chartreuse hair and fingernails. What's more, I heard her saying, "In payment for all the trouble you've caused us, this body is to be addressed to me at New York, delivered in good condition, no later than next Monday." "Yes, ma'am," said the judge. When we got home, the Pioneer's Day parade was just breaking up at the local storage center, and the parade marshal got out of his body and apologized to me for acting the way he had. "Heck, Herb," I said, "you don't need to apologize. You weren't yourself. You were parading around in a body." That's the best part of being amphibious, next to not being afraid. People forgive you for whatever fool thing you might have done in a body. Oh, there are drawbacks, I guess, the way there are drawbacks to everything. We still have to work off and on, maintaining the storage centers and getting food to keep the community bodies going. But that's a small drawback. And all the big drawbacks I ever heard of aren't real ones, just old-fashioned thinking by people who can't stop worrying about things they used to worry about before they turned amphibious. As I say, the oldsters will probably never really get used to it. Every so often, I catch myself getting gloomy over what happened to the pay toilet business it took me 30 years to build. But the youngsters don't have any hangovers like that from the past. They don't even worry much about something happening to the storage centers the way us oldsters do. So I guess maybe that'll be the next step in evolution. To break clean like those first amphibians who crawled out of the mud into the sunshine, and who never did go back to the sea.
The Kid Nobody Could Handle, read by Bill Irwin. It was 7:30 in the morning. Waddling, clanking, muddy machines were tearing a hill to pieces behind a restaurant, and trucks were hauling the pieces away. Inside the restaurant, dishes rattled on their shelves. Tables quaked, and a very kind fat man with a head full of music looked down at the jiggling yolks of his breakfast eggs. His wife was visiting relatives out of town. He was on his own. The kind fat man was George M. Helmholtz, a man of 40, head of the music department of Lincoln High School, and director of the band. Life had treated him well. Each year he dreamed the same big dream. He dreamed of leading as fine a band as there was on the face of the earth. And each year, the dream came true. It came true because Helmholtz was sure that a man couldn't have a better dream than his. Faced by this unnerving sureness, Kiwanians, Rotarians, and Lions paid for band uniforms that cost twice as much as their best suits. School administrators let Helmholtz raid the budget for expensive props, and youngsters played their hearts out for him. When youngsters had no talent, Helmholtz made them play on guts alone. Everything was good about Helmholtz's life, save his finances. He was so dazzled by his big dream that he was a child in the marketplace. 10 years before, he had sold the hill behind the restaurant to Bert Quinn, the restaurant owner, for $1,000. It was now apparent, even to Helmholtz, that Helmholtz had been had. Quinn sat down in the booth with the bandmaster. He was a bachelor, a small, dark, humorless man. He wasn't a well man. He couldn't sleep. He couldn't stop working. He couldn't smile warmly. He had only two moods, one suspicious and self-pitying, the other arrogant and boastful. The first mood applied when he was losing money. The second mood applied when he was making it. Quinn was in the arrogant and boastful mood when he sat down with Helmholtz. He sucked whistlingly on a toothpick and talked of vision. His own. "I wonder how many eyes saw the hill before I did," said Quinn. "Thousands and thousands, I'll bet. And not one saw what I saw. How many eyes?" "Mine, at least," said Helmholtz. All the hill had meant to him was a panting climb, free blackberries, taxes, and a place for band picnics. "You inherit the hill from your old man, and it's nothing but a pain in the neck to you," said Quinn, "so you figure you'll stick me with it." "I didn't figure to stick you," Helmholtz protested. "The good Lord knows the price was more than fair." "You say that now," said Quinn gleefully. "Sure, Helmholtz, you say that now. Now you see the shopping district's gotta grow. Now you see what I saw." "Yes," said Helmholtz. "Too late. Too late." He looked around for some diversion and saw a 15-year-old boy coming toward him, mopping the aisle between booths. The boy was small, but with tough, stringy muscles standing out on his neck and forearms. Childhood lingered in his features, but when he paused to rest, his fingers went hopefully to the silky beginnings of sideburns and a mustache. He mopped like a robot, jerkily, brainlessly, but took pains not to splash suds over the toes of his black boots. "So what do I do when I get the hill?" said Quinn. "I tear it down, and it's like somebody pulled down a dam. All of a sudden, everybody wants to build a store where the hill was." Said Helmholtz. He smiled genially at the boy. The boy looked through him without a twitch of recognition. "We all got something," said Quinn. "You got music, I got vision." And he smiled, for it was perfectly clear to both where the money lay. "Think big," said Quinn. "Dream big, that's what vision is. Keep your eyes wider open than anybody else's." "That boy," said Helmholtz, "I've seen him around school, but I never knew his name." Quinn laughed cheerlessly. "Billy the Kid, the Stormtrooper, Rudolph Valentino, Flash Gordon," he called the boy. "Hey, Jim, come here a minute." Helmholtz was appalled to see that the boy's eyes were as expressionless as oysters. "This is my brother-in-law's kid by another marriage, before he married my sister," said Quinn. "His name's Jim Donini, and he's from the south side of Chicago, and he's very tough." Jim Donini's hands tightened on the mop handle. "How do you do?" said Helmholtz. "Hi," said Jim emptily. "He's living with me now," said Quinn. "He's my baby now."
"You want a lift to school, Jim?"
"Yeah, he wants a lift to school," said Quinn. "See what you make of him. He won't talk to me." He turned to Jim. "Go on, kid, wash up and shave."
Robot-like, Jim marched away. "Where are his parents?"
"His mother's dead. His old man married my sister, walked out on her, and stuck her with him. Then the court didn't like the way she was raising him and put him in foster homes for a while. Then they decided to get him clear out of Chicago, so they stuck me with him."
He shook his head. "Life's a funny thing, Helmholtz."
"Not very funny, sometimes," said Helmholtz. He pushed his eggs away. "Like some whole new race of people coming up," said Quinn wonderingly. "Nothing like the kids we got around here. Those boots, the black jacket, and he won't talk. He won't run around like the other kids. Won't study. I don't think he can even read and write very good."
"Does he like music at all, or drawing, or animals?" said Helmholtz. "Does he collect anything?"
"You know what he likes?" said Quinn. "He likes to polish those boots. Get off by himself and polish those boots. And when he's really in heaven is when he can get off by himself, spread comic books all around him on the floor, polish his boots, and watch television."
He smiled ruefully.
"Yeah, he had a collection, too. And I took it away from him and threw it in the river."
"Threw it in the river?" said Helmholtz.
"Yeah," said Quinn. 8 knives, some with blades as long as your hand. Helmholtz paled. Oh. A prickling sensation spread over the back of his neck. This is a new problem at Lincoln High. I hardly know what to think about it. He swept spilled salt together in a neat little pile, just as he would have liked to sweep together his scattered thoughts. It's a kind of sickness, isn't it? That's the way to look at it.
Sick? Said Quinn.
He slapped the table.
You can say that again, he tapped his chest. And Dr. Quinn is just the man to give him what's good for what ails him.
What's that? Said Helmholtz.
No more talk about the poor little sick boy, said Quinn grimly. That's all he's heard from social workers and the juvenile court and God knows who all. From now on, he's the no-good bum of a man. I'll ride his tail till he straightens up and flies right or winds up in the can for life, one way or the other.
I see, said Helmholtz. Like listening to music? Said Helmholtz to Jim brightly as they rode to school in Helmholtz's car. Jim said nothing. He was stroking his mustache and sideburns, which he had not shaved off. Ever drum with the fingers or keep time with your feet? Said Helmholtz. He had noticed that Jim's boots were decorated with chains that had no function but to jingle as he walked. Jim sighed with ennui. Or whistle? Said Helmholtz. If you do any of those things, it's just like picking up the keys to a whole new world, a world as beautiful as any world can be. Jim gave a soft Bronx cheer.
There, said Helmholtz.
You've illustrated the basic principle of the family of brass wind instruments. The glorious voice of every one of them starts with a buzz on the lips. The seat springs of Helmholtz's old car creaked under Jim as Jim shifted his weight. Helmholtz took this as a sign of interest, and he turned to smile in comradely fashion. But Jim had shifted his weight in order to get a cigarette from inside his tight leather jacket. Helmholtz was too upset to comment at once. It was only at the end of the ride, as he turned into the teacher's parking lot, that he thought of something to say.
Sometimes, said Helmholtz, I get so lonely and disgusted.